You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Obama discussed strategies to further weaken ISIS in a press conference this afternoon. We find out what he laid out and whether it's likely to succeed.
First, the opening ceremonies at the Olympics kick off tomorrow, and experts are worried about Zika, which has hit the host city of Rio de Janeiro very hard. The Centers for Disease Control also just released an unprecedented travel warning earlier this week. The warning advised pregnant women and their partners to avoid travel to a small community north of Miami, where Zika is actively circulating. It's the first time the CDC advised people not to travel to an American neighborhood.
Dave O'Connor joins us now to talk about what researchers are doing to predict the next Zika, the next big viral outbreak. He's a professor in the Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at UW-Madison. Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, Dave, we saw a number. Since 1980, the global number of viral outbreaks per year has tripled. Are we really seeing that many more viral outbreaks, or are we getting better at detecting them?
I think it could be a combination of both. Certainly, the ease with which people can travel across the world in a day or two, combined with the fact that we have better surveillance for viruses and better tools to detect new viruses, means that it's easier than ever to see that these types of outbreaks are occurring. The question is how many of those new outbreaks that we're seeing, or new viruses that we're seeing, are ones that we really have to worry a lot about in terms of their impact on health.
Right, and that's the big question. How do you look at this world jam-packed with different kinds of viruses and figure out which is the one that is going to be a health hazard around the world?
Right, and that's the million-dollar question. I don't think there is a single good way. There is no single smoking gun that we can use to see a virus that we don't know very much about and say, this is one that we need to be worried about, and this if it hasn't already impacted people's health. So, you know, to paraphrase from an old Simpsons episode, you know, the NIH isn't going to give money for viruses that don't make us sick yet.
Where do a lot of the more recent viral outbreaks we've seen come from?
Well, in terms of where they arise from, many come from animal reservoirs. So either livestock or wild animals, and certainly as people have encroached upon the natural habitats of animals and there's increasing interactions between people and animals, those sorts of viral transmission events are more likely. In terms of where most of those viruses are coming from, it seems like regions near the equator seem to be particularly vulnerable in terms of having viruses jump between people and animals, and then between different species and animals.
Why would that be? Is it that there are just more species closer to the equator?
Yeah, I think it's that. And then you also have a lot of habitat loss associated with a number of factors, including increasing population density. And then also more recently, the changing climate is, you know, stressing ecosystems in a way that it hasn't before. And it's putting animals and people in places where they haven't come into contact previously.
Could it be the situation in some cases that there's a human population that has been in contact with this virus for a long time, but it only spreads more when it comes into contact with a different group of people, with the world we can travel really easily in?
Sure. And so initially, when Zika virus was first seen in Brazil, suspicion immediately was put to the World Cup that had been in Brazil in 2014, and the suggestion had been that someone who had traveled to the World Cup had brought Zika to Brazil. Now we think it was probably not the World Cup, but perhaps the Confederations Cup that happened a year before, or some other event that brought together people, particularly from the Pacific Islands, to Brazil. But the point's the same. People came from one part of the world to another part of the world and brought a virus that was able to get a toehold in a new population.
We're talking to Dave O'Connor with the Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at UW-Madison about efforts to predict the next Zika, the next Ebola, viruses that are out there in nature and animals, maybe in our livestock, that can make the jump to humans. Let's look at that livestock part of things. I know different kinds of flu strains are often associated with livestock. Do we have kind of a warning system for possible viral pathogens there?
Yeah, I think the flu field has really led the way in terms of establishing surveillance around the world, looking in birds, looking in livestock, and looking in people, and trying to very quickly identify when there are flu strains that have some of the attributes that we might associate with severe human infections. But again, truthfully, we don't really know what we're looking for in terms of new types of flu that haven't made people sick in the past. We can only look for those types of flus that have signatures of strains that have previously made people sick. So when we don't know what we don't know.
Do we have general good practices in place for when there's a new viral outbreak for behavioral reactions we can make, efforts to research vaccines, our reaction, or are we just always scrambling to catch up?
Well, I hope that these the series of outbreaks that we've seen in the last several years, beginning with Ebola and now with Zika, is going to lead to a more coordinated response. I would say that the response still tends to be somewhat fractured, and certainly with Zika, you can look at the slowness with which there's been a concentrated, coordinated federal response, and see that it's not as seamless as perhaps it could be. You have lots of stakeholders in government, in academics, in pharmaceutical companies, in small biotech, all sort of working towards the same general goals, but without a whole lot of coordination. And frankly, some of that coordination has to be driven by funding, which has sometimes been slow to materialize.
Is it the problem that we just do funding like, oh, there's Ebola, we need Ebola funding, or, oh, there's Zika, we need Zika funding, as opposed to there will be viruses in the future, we need public health infrastructure, state, national, international to deal with it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we have FEMA because we know that there are going to be emergencies that the federal government is going to have to come in and manage. And Tom Frieden of the CDC has suggested that we have a FEMA with a PH to deal with public health emergencies that we know are going to come in the future, but that we can't predict as a line item today. So have a set of people and funds and infrastructure in place that can mobilize quickly when these sorts of epidemics begin to occur without necessarily having to know ahead of time what they're going to be.
I think in a lot of people's minds, well, I'll say my mind anyway, that's what we think the CDC is there for. That's what happens in the movies. The guys in the CDC lab suits show up when there's the outbreak. That's not really what the CDC is laid out to do?
Well, the CDC does that to some extent, but the CDC has limited resources itself and is spread across a wide variety of different types of diseases. So they can come in and do some of the epidemiology, but there's a lot of basic research, vaccine development, therapeutic design, developing other interventions, testing behavioral changes, mobilizing, you know, marketing and social marketing to raise awareness that the CDC can't do all on their own. If you were to organize something like FEMA under the aegis of the CDC, that would be entirely reasonable, but it has to be a multifaceted response that goes beyond just surveying for the presence of people who have a particular virus.
Now, if I were in your line of work looking at potential future viral outbreaks, I think I'd be a very much a basket case. I'd be very scared about what's out there. Is that how you feel, or should we be more a little more calm than that about the world of dangerous viruses out there?
Well, I think you can look at something like Zika, and you can be reassured because 80 to 90% of the people who are going to get it aren't even going to know that they've been infected. So you use these sophisticated diagnostic tests to determine that someone has a virus in their blood that didn't make them sick, that didn't cause any illness. And for most people, most of the time, we are living in a microbial world. We have viral infections, all of us, all the time. And we don't know it. It doesn't necessarily make us sick. It's when you have viruses that begin to behave unusually. So in the case of Zika, the two unusual attributes are the fact that it seems to be associated with causing fetal birth defects, and that it has modes of transmission that are unusual for a virus that's spread by a mosquito. It can be transmitted sexually, for example. When a virus stops playing by the rules, then we need to work really hard to figure out what the sort of risks are. But we need to realize that at an individual level, the risks are still quite low.
Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, thanks for having me. Take care.
We've been talking to Dave O'Connor, professor in the Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about how researchers are trying to find the next big viral outbreak. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, the Vietnam War era was a time of great upheaval here in Wisconsin and across the nation. We talk about the pivotal years of 1969 and 1970.
First, President Obama met with military advisors to discuss ISIS. A press conference today, this afternoon, he spoke to lay out strategies.
Joining us to discuss the president's remarks and whether they represent a new direction in the nation's counterterrorism efforts is Don Heider-Markell. He's a professor of political science at the University of Kansas. He specializes in civil rights, criminal justice, and counterterrorism. Don, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
So how would you summarize what the president's plan is for defeating ISIS? Has it changed? Has it shifted?
Well, from what I've heard, there's not a big dramatic change in the policy, and the policy is largely one of counterterrorism operations that don't directly involve the use of United States military force, but largely through intelligence and cooperating with other countries from Europe to the Middle East. And then when that cooperation allows for the use of U.S. military force, and it's advised by the armed services, the president has gone forward with that. But it's certainly not one of a large footprint on the ground to combat ISIS in Iraq, Syria, or in Libya.
Well, and as you just outlined there, there are so many pieces to this ISIS puzzle, and the approach to defeating them can be hard to kind of gauge what has happened and whether there's progress or losing ground. This is how the president gave an overview of the situation.
2 years ago, ISIL was racing across Iraq to the outskirts of Baghdad itself, and to many observers, ISIL looked invincible. Since then, in Iraq, ISIL has lost at the Manjib Dam, at Tikrit, at Beji, at Sinjar, at Ramadi, at Heat, at Rutba, and now Fallujah. In Syria, ISIL's lost at Kobani and Tal Abayad, and the Tishrin Dam and al-Shaddadi. ISIL has lost territory across vast stretches of the border with Turkey and almost all major transit routes into Raqqa. And in both Iraq and Syria, ISIL has not been able to reclaim any significant territory that they have lost. So I want to repeat, ISIL has not had a major successful offensive operation in either Syria or Iraq in a full year. Even ISIL's leaders know they're going to keep losing.
So from how the president laid out chronologically and geographically the losses that ISIS has suffered, it would seem that the U.S. and its allies are succeeding, but that's not the general tone in the nation and in the public opinion.
No, and part of the difficulty here is that ISIS has not operated in the same way as a traditional terrorist organization has. By claiming large swaths of territory and trying to hold those territories and govern those territories, they've acted somewhat more like a nation state than a terrorist organization. And now they're sort of being pushed back into operating more like a traditional terrorist organization. They've lost ground, and for them, that is a failure. But for, as I say, for a traditional terrorist organization, that's not a primary objective of the organization. So I think in some ways you see here comparing ISIS to Al-Qaeda or other groups that people might be more aware of, you can see that the sort of advances that have been made against ISIS for our typical ways of thinking about a terrorist organization, they don't seem like tremendous gains. They're still able to operate. They're still able to carry out attacks in the Middle East, in Europe. They're still able to inspire others in the West. And therefore, they seem to somehow be succeeding. But that's sort of then folding them into the model of the typical terrorist group. And I think in some ways, for many, many years, they'll be able to be successful at that level, low-level kinds of attacks, be it in the West or elsewhere. Even if they lose 99% of their territory, they're going to be able to pull off those kinds of attacks.
In the NPR coverage leading up to the press conference, commentator Ron Elving, actually with some frustration in his own voice, asked why it is that if if ISIS is in retreat or is losing ground, is being hemmed in, why, with the combined power of the U.S. and its allies, it is so hard to just, as he put it, obliterate ISIS? Why is it? You said that they will probably continue to be able to function. Why is it so hard to completely eliminate that threat?
Well, we can't ever completely eliminate a threat from individuals who seek to inspire or even carry out small scale attacks on their own. As long as they're motivated by the ideology that they have, they'll always find somebody to do that. They don't need tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of supporters. What they need is just a few people that are always willing to go forward with their agenda. The difference is here, I think, in part, we could go into Iraq, we could even go into Syria, we could go into Libya, and we have the military force to completely eliminate most of the active members of ISIS in those areas. But that doesn't put an end to ISIS. There will still be adherents. New adherents will be inspired by past actions of ISIS. You don't simply eliminate the ideology. You can eliminate primary members of the group, but you can't eliminate the ideology. The other part is, if you go in and take them out of those areas, then who governs? Who rules then? In Iraq and Syria and even in Libya, the existing governments have already shown that they've been ineffective at governance. And who takes over then? The whole reason Iraq and Syria were such large areas of those countries were taken over by ISIS is because there was no legitimate government in large portions of those countries, and ISIS came in and took over that role. So I think it's not just a question of can we use military force, can we eliminate most of this group with military force. We can. It's simply what comes after that, and the fact of the threat of terrorism and extremist ideologies doesn't just disappear because you get rid of primary adherents. There still will be those that are inspired.
We're talking with Don Heider Markell, a professor of political science at the University of Kansas, about President Obama's press conference today on future strategies to defeat ISIS. And you were just talking, Don, about kind of what happens in that vacuum if ISIS is further and further isolated and maybe not rendered completely powerless, but has its power and control limited. He talked about what might happen in that decline.
The decline of ISIL in Syria and Iraq appears to be causing it to shift to tactics that we've seen before, an even greater emphasis on encouraging high-profile terrorist attacks, including in the United States.
So there, it sounds something of a warning to the U.S. public and to the populations of our allied nations that this could actually see more violence from ISIS instead of less.
Right, and that's typically what we see from terrorist organizations, whether it's sort of targeted efforts to take out leadership or targeted efforts to harm large portions of the group. The response is typically one of increased levels of violence, increased dramatic violence, even if those are relatively small scale, to show that the group is still active and for potential new leaders to show to their followers that they have the sort of guts to sort of carry out these dramatic kinds of attacks. So this is very common. Even other kinds of large-scale groups like the Taliban in Afghanistan, this has been the sort of common response to taking out leaders or to failures by the group in controlling areas of Afghanistan has been to sort of lash out with a bunch of quick acts of violence and demonstrate that they are still active.
One of the things that President Obama said was kind of drawing a distinction between the U.S. and allies purposely trying to avoid civilian casualties, whereas ISIS trying to cause civilian casualties to kind of strike fear into the hearts of civilian populations. But I'm wondering, you who studies counterterrorism and not just our responses, but, you know, how the other side is thinking and their perceptions, I'm not sure that people on the ground in Syria, Libya, Iraq would agree with the fact that the U.S. and its allies are always good about avoiding civilians.
No, and even if we've gotten much better at it, and I think we have, there's still a large-scale narrative out there that you know, and examples you can point to where civilians were killed dramatically, where women and children are killed in a strike or a special operations operation, and those kinds of circumstances will always sort of be available. That counter narrative is always out there, and unless we were absolutely perfect at ensuring no civilians were killed, I think that potential is always there.
The president also talked about some recent intelligence finds.
As ISIL's beaten back, we're gaining vast amounts of intelligence, thousands of documents, thumb drives, digital files, which we will use to keep destroying ISIL's networks and stop foreign fighters.
So I think anyone would say more intelligence is better than less, but it seems the way you were describing the shift in ISIS and their tactics and what we've just seen as far as attacks in the U.S. and in our allied countries, these are not necessarily people carrying out attacks who are even on the radar or might even be within the ISIS network officially to even be turn up in that intelligence.
That's right. I mean, the greatest kinds of threats that we potentially face are those so-called lone wolf attackers who don't really have any connection to the group, who are sort of self-radicalized or self-inspired by the group's propaganda. And those people, like any regular criminal, are really hard to uncover because they're not engaged in the kinds of activities that we're actively monitoring. And therefore, you know, they only, in order to carry out their attack, they only have to get it right one time, whereas those trying to prevent or defend that kind of attack have to be right 100% of the time to make sure it doesn't happen. And that's simply not possible. I mean, no counterterrorism effort can be 100% correct all of the time.
Well, Don, thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you.
That was Don Heider-Markell. He's a professor of political science at the University of Kansas. He specializes in civil rights, criminal justice, and counterterrorism. And he was with us to discuss what President Obama spoke about at a press conference this afternoon after meeting with military leaders and advisors on the continuing fight against ISIS.
Coming up, Wisconsin was a hotbed of anti-war sentiment and activity in the late 1960s. We'll talk to the author of a new book that tells the story of that unrest through first-person accounts. I'm Rob Ferrick.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today after 7, it's the Moth Radio Hour. Among tonight's stories, a literary woman sparks a romance with a New York City fireman, and Jim Beam's great-grandson describes growing up under the watchful eye of his famous Kentucky bourbon family. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, the Vietnam War and military interventions in Cambodia and Laos stretched over a decade, but the years 1969 and 1970 were both a climax and turning point of the anti-war movement and police and government reactions to it.
While the nation as a whole was in turmoil, Wisconsin played a high-profile role in both protests against the war and a rejection of violent means to end it. Do you remember that period? Were you here in Wisconsin then in 1969, 1970? What's your memory of how the mood in the state and the country changed in those years? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Clara Bingham has written a sprawling history of those two pivotal years through a series of first-person interviews that she conducted. The book is Witness to the Revolution: Radicals, Resistors, Vets, Hippies, and the Year America Lost Its Mind and Found Its Soul. Clara, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So how did you decide to write specifically about August 1969 through August 1970?
Well, I missed it. I was born in 1963, so I was just, I was very young during the late part of the 60s, but it was such an important part of my life because I grew up in New York City on Central Park West, and my playground was the staging ground for so many different protest movements in the late 60s and early 70s. And so I realized that my life had really changed because of the 60s. I could study at any college and have any job that I wanted, partly because of all these different protest movements, but that I really didn't understand, you know, why everything had changed so quickly. And I wanted to look back now when people are into their 60s and 70s who were activists during that time and talk to them about what they did in the late 60s and get a sense of why those years were so crucial to changing who we are as a country. So I decided to go on an adventure, and I spent about 3 years traveling around the country interviewing. In the end, it was 100 activists who took part in different parts of the movement for social change.
And in the title of your book, you reference radicals, resistors, vets, and hippies. How did those groups shape that period, particularly that period at the very end of the 1960s?
Well, I decided to focus on the school year of 69-70 because I felt that that was really the crescendo of the 60s. It was a time when so much social unrest took place, and there was a huge student strike that took place after the Kent State shootings, which are in May. And after that, 2.5 million students in 700 colleges didn't go to back to school. And we really came as close as we ever had to a civil war. I mean, there was just a massive generational massive generational gap going on. And so I wanted to talk to people who are in different parts of the movement. And so I talked to radicals who were part of SDS, the Student for Democratic Society, that then split off, and some of them became the Weathermen. I talked to resistors who were draft resistors, people like David Harris, who started a organization called The Resistance, and hundreds of thousands of people resisted the draft, young men at the time, and then also to vets. Many Vietnam vets came back from the war by 69 and 70 and became involved in the anti-war movement. And then, of course, hippies, who were part of the cultural change that was going on at the time. So all of these different groups were very, very active in the late 60s. And so it really created a perfect storm of protest.
And so let's talk about that academic year, as you said, and it does make a lot of sense because so much activity was going on the college campuses around the country. Let's zero in specifically on Wisconsin. What did your interviews tell you about what was going on in Wisconsin in the latter part of 69 to start with?
Well, a lot. I mean, Wisconsin, the University of Wisconsin-Madison was one of the most radical and violent campuses in the country. And I decided that, you know, everyone had heard about what had happened at Berkeley and Columbia and even Harvard. But in fact, Madison, what happened at Madison was more important. And there was a student protest that lasted for years and years there. I mean, the National Guard practically moved on to campus. And one of the first protests that began the whole protest student protest movement was at Madison in October of 1967, when about 300 students staged a sit-in in protest of Dow Chemical, the manufacturer of napalm that at the time was recruiting students to go and work for them, and also the university was involved in research for Dow Chemical. And so that particular protest was extremely violent because the Madison police force came down very strong and beat all of the protesters who were peaceful at the time with billy clubs, and there was a lot of blood and a lot of hospitalization, and it really radicalized the rest of the campus, excuse me, because they witnessed so much brutality. And it kind of kicked off another 2 to 3 years of intensive, constant protest. So I interviewed several members of student members who were involved at the time in Madison, and it was really fascinating to hear how so many parts of that campus were really erupting. Later on in 69, there was something called the Mifflin Street riot, where police went into Mifflin Street, which was a part of the campus where a lot of the countercultural and political students lived, and beat everybody up, threw tear gas out, and it was a sort of a very intensive and violent moment, few days. And so I talked to policemen who were involved in that riot, and then students who were there, and so it was fascinating to try to paint a portrait of what was going on in Madison at that time.
We're talking with Clara Bingham about her new book, Witness to the Revolution, Radicals, Resistors, Vets, Hippies, and the Year America Lost Its Mind and Found Its Soul. Well, let's talk a little more about who was being caught up in these anti-war protests, or people that were supporting the government, whether they were in an official capacity like police or like National Guard or just members of the public. You talk about those very distinct groups, and those are often the groups that you see in photos and hear from in histories. But what was the general mood of the public, maybe not people who were involved in college campuses, but, you know, out in the rest of the state, out in the rest of the country?
Well, I mean, there was, of course, the country was very deeply divided. And President Nixon, who was elected in 1968, called his supporters the silent majority. We've been hearing that that phrase because Trump has been using it as well. And Nixon did have a majority following him. Ultimately, he was reelected in 1972 in a landslide. So, the older people who were over 30 tended to support Nixon and were very much against the young hippies who were taking to the streets and changing not just the political realm, but also the social realm. So there was so much going on. There was the beginning of feminism and gay rights. There was, lots of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And so it seemed as if the country was really coming apart at its seams. And many Americans were very threatened by this, and it was scary. There was a deep, deep divide between the youth generation, and this was, of course, the beginning of the baby boom. For example, in 1964, college enrollment increased by 37%. So it was the beginning of the post-World War II baby boom generation. There were a lot of them then. And, they became involved in the civil rights movement in the early to mid 60s. And then, of course, the Vietnam War and the draft picked up by 1965. And, so students who had begun organizing in the early part of the decade then, became very organized against the war. And so the country was divided, but Madison was this one important campus where the students were very radicalized. And it was interesting because about 50% of the undergraduates, or one-third of the undergraduates were from out of state at that time, and 50% of the graduates were from out of state. So it was unusual for a state university to have so many out-of-state students. And I think that had something to do with why Madison was so radical at the time.
So in some ways, it was a microcosm. We're talking with Clara Bingham about her new book, Witness to the Revolution, Radicals, Resistors, Vets, Hippies, and the Year America Lost Its Mind and Found Its Soul.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your memories of the events of 1969 and 1970? Were you one of the radicals, resistors, protesters, vets, and hippies that our guest is writing about. Were you there at protests, watching, participating on the police force? Were you watching from elsewhere in the state, elsewhere in the country? What did you think watching what was going on? What did you think of the war in Vietnam? How did things change? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation now with Clara Bingham. Her new book is Witness to the Revolution: Radicals, Resistors, Vets, Hippies, and the Year America Lost Its Mind and Found Its Soul.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where were you in those pivotal years, 1969, 1970? Were you protesting the war? Were you serving in the military? What did you think of what was going on in those pivotal years? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Clara, certainly one of the most significant events in that year that you write about and here in Wisconsin was the bombing of Sterling Hall on the UW-Madison campus, which occurred in the early hours of August 24th, 1970. Why was Sterling Hall a focus of the anti-war movement?
Sterling Hall, which is also called the Army Math Research Center, was the building where a lot of the research for Dow Chemical took place. So it was a science center where the Department of Defense had contracts out to the University of Wisconsin for studies that most likely had to do with napalm and other weapons that were being used in the Vietnam War. And so the Daily Cardinal, the very popular student newspaper that was also quite investigative and influential, had published a series of articles in 1969 and 70 about the connections between the university and General Electric and Dow Chemical and all of this research that was going on at the Army Math Research Center or Sterling Hall. So that building became symbolic, in a sense, of the, you know, military-industrial complex and the Vietnam War that was being waged by the administration. So it was a important symbol that the anti-war activists in Madison decided they wanted to destroy. And so it was actually very, I talked to Carl Armstrong, who was the leader essentially of four students and former students at the time who bombed that building on August 24th. Leading up to that, which I think is important to know, in May, the National Guard in Ohio shot 13 students, killing four who were protesting peacefully against the invasion of Cambodia. So that had just occurred in early May. And as I mentioned earlier, students all over the country went on strike. In Madison, 84 Wisconsin students were arrested after conducting 20 firebombings. So in Madison, it was even worse than in a lot of other campuses. There were a lot of firebombings, and Governor Warren Knowles deployed 2,100 National Guardsmen to quell the campus revolt. So it was a very violent time, and there was a lot of protests. And then, just before school started up again in late August, Carl Armstrong, his brother Dwight, and two other men who had worked at the Daily Cardinal at the time pulled a van up to the sort of drive in front of the Army Math building, Sterling Hall. They had been watching the building for several weeks to see when people were there, when they were not. They had planned to do this bombing at a time when no one was in the building. It was about 2:30 in the morning, and the lights were on. They didn't really know that in fact someone was there, and they detonated a truck bomb that they had created And just by learning from the Encyclopedia Britannica how to make bombs, it was a pretty rudimentary bomb. And unfortunately, they later discovered that a 33-year-old researcher named Robert Fosnock was in the building, and he was killed. He was a young father. He also apparently was against the war. So this was a terrible mistake and tragedy. And in many ways, people think that this tragic event was kind of the beginning of the end of the anti-war movement.
And I want to take a couple of our calls, Clara. So let's go to the phones. And Clarence in Watertown is up first. Hi, Clarence.
Good morning, or good afternoon, actually. Yes, August 4th, I left the United States for Vietnam to serve in the United States Army. I was drafted, and when the draft notice came in, I said, okay, I enlisted. And I couldn't believe, I knew that Madison was a hotbed of dissent and everything, and it was pointed out to me that a lot of these students are just little more than older kids. I mean, they haven't had jobs, paid taxes, held, you know, responsible employment, and that they, I don't know, it just seemed to me they got away from home and they just went crazy with screwy ideas.
All right, Clarence, thank you for that perspective. And let's go right away to Janet in Milwaukee. Hi, Janet.
Hi. 1968 was the year that I graduated from high school. And there was no celebration at graduation because all of our brothers and our fellow male students were being drafted. And so we were very much against the Vietnam War. And I also remember the convention in Chicago. But to the point, we bought an old pie truck and we outfitted it with mattresses and whatever things that we would need. We took a map and we found all the universities that were protesting, and we went across the country protesting the war. We really felt strongly about it, enough so that we didn't go to college. We put up our own college so that we could protest that war. And so everything that you're talking about, I can relate to very.
And Janet, I want to ask you, because we're running short on time, how did you respond as someone who was part of the anti-war effort? How did you respond to the bombing of Sterling Hall?
Oh, I remember it very, very clearly. And I understood the reason for the bombing, but I also understood that, an innocent person was killed because of that.
And thank you very much for that call, Janet, and also for Clarence before her. And Clara, let's actually listen to a clip of current Madison Mayor Paul Soglin, who was a prominent figure at the time and one of the people you spoke with.
I felt that all of us on the left did have some sort of responsibility for what had happened, in that we had allowed what we call the crazies. We allowed them to take this too far.
And Clara, in just the minute or so we have left, Sterling Hall really did turn the movement, didn't it?
Well, did it? It also at that time, the movement was about a year, had about another year to go before it petered out. but it really was it was shocking to have killed someone by mistake. And it also proved that the violent part of the movement, the people like the Weathermen, also this group who bombed Sterling Hall, were not involved with the Weathermen, but there were many people who were very militant. And that is, as Paul Soglin says, the crazies, that they didn't really represent a majority of the movement. And they also hurt the movement because they alienated other people who might be, sympathetic and were anti-war but didn't want to be part of this fringe group. So as one person I talked to said, those sort of bombings really were the best thing that could ever happen to Nixon.
Clara, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today. Clara Bingham is the author of Witness to the Revolution, Radicals, Resistors, Vets, Hippies, and the Year America Lost Its Mind and Found Its Soul. You can share your memories of 1969 and 1970 by stopping by the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us what you remember and tell us where you were when these events were going on.
Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time on the Ideas Network.